This is the BBC third programme. During the next 11 weeks, we shall be broadcasting a series of 20 programmes under the title America Since the Bomb, edited by D.G. Brideson. In this talk, America Comes of Nuclear Age, he introduces the series.
If it could be said that while some nations are born great, others have greatness thrust upon them, America is probably the only nation that could fairly lay claim to both distinctions. The greatness to which America was born was a greatness of size, of remoteness from interference, and of opportunity for development. Born in isolation, she turned isolation into independence, and in defense of that independence, she took as the cornerstone of her foreign policy what now we should call isolationism. There were two authorities for such a policy. In his farewell address to the Union, Washington had commented upon America's remoteness from Europe and asked why, by interweaving her destiny with that of any part of Europe, should America entangle her peace and prosperity in the European toils of rivalry or self-interest. The point was made again in the Monroe Doctrine, by which America steered her international course for the next 120-odd years. The First World War, admittedly, had brought her troops to Europe, but the reason had been essentially a matter of protecting America's interests, for which the Monroe Doctrine had made careful allowance, and the resumption of peace and normalcy had seen America retire once more into traditional isolationism. The Second World War saw American troops engaged in the fight for control of Europe a second time, to say nothing of Asia and the Pacific. But once again, American interests were seen to be at stake, most notably, of course, at Pearl Harbor. It was only with the end of World War II that America seemed to be changing her traditional policy. The Truman Doctrine, for instance, appeared to be drawn up in contradiction of at least a part of the Monroe Doctrine, though once again the Monroe Doctrine had left a convenient loophole. In the event that change shall occur which, in the judgment of the competent authorities, shall make a corresponding change on the part of the United States indispensable to their security. The discovery and the threat of the atomic bomb undoubtedly marked such a change. To modern ears, there is something quaint and almost pathetic in the idea of isolationism today. Who, for instance, could regard seriously a statement like ex-President Hoover's?
We Americans alone, with our sea and air power, can so control the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans that there can be no possible invasion of the Western Hemisphere by communist armies. They can no more reach Washington in force than we can reach Moscow.
That statement, incidentally, was made only 15 years ago, well within the nuclear age. But even in 1951, there were few Americans who could accept it as realistic. The age of isolationism was long since over. The bomb had changed all that. The series of programs opening on third program tomorrow night with Auden's Age of Anxiety as its prologue is designed to trace the course of that change. For America Since the Bomb is a story which examines the course of the change step by step. The main facts of the story will be told in three large-scale documentaries, Korea to Vietnam, and will deal for the most part with history as it was being created, in speech, in debate, in action and results. It will draw upon radio's archives for most of its material, for much of modern history has been made, and all of it reported, in terms of radio. But the series will attempt to do more than tell the story of America's involvement in world affairs. It will also try to show how that involvement has been reflected in American thinking at home, in American habits and reactions, in American writing and argument and belief. Not least of all, in American song. Let me offer you an example.
Hiroshima, Nagasaki paid a big price for their sins. When scorched from the face of earth, their battle could not win. But on that day of judgment, when comes a greater power, we will not know the minute, and we will not know the hour. Atomic power, atomic power, was given by the mighty hand of God. Atomic power, atomic power, it was given by the mighty hand of God.
Did Americans ever really feel quite so cozy about life in the nuclear age? Or was the number a skit on coziness? Well, at least one can remember a famous newspaper photograph of the wedding cake made in the shape of a mushroom cloud. And there is really nothing wrong in believing that security is given by the mighty hand of God, provided you're sure you enjoy it. Unfortunately, security is not possible in the nuclear age, or at least it is not possible yet. And fears for one's security can result in a strange loss of perspective. The spy scare in America, about which Alistair Cook will be talking next week, was the first reaction of America to her own discovery of the bomb. McCarthyism, about which Emile D'Antonio will be talking, reflects the first results of the bomb neurosis. Not that McCarthyism went altogether unchallenged in America. Indeed, it was roundly denounced at the time by Harry Truman, who defined it as follows.
It is the abandonment of due process of law. It is the use of the big lie and the unfounded accusation against any citizen in the name of Americanism and security. It is the rise to power of the demagogue who lives on untruth. It is the spread of fear and the destruction of faith in every level of our society.
The protest song provided an obvious reaction to the witch hunt, and it might be argued that sick humor is a defensive reaction to statements like the famous utterance of President Eisenhower.
Atomic bombs today are more than 25 times as powerful as the weapons with which the atomic age dawned, while hydrogen weapons are in the ranges of millions of tons of TNT equivalent. Today, the United States stockpile of atomic weapons, which of course increases daily, exceeds by many times the total equivalent of the total of all bombs and all shells that came from every plane and every gun in every theater of war in all of the years of World War II.
It is not surprising that the bomb gave rise to the Cold War. The bomb, initially at any rate, required bases, and bases required convenient territory. Nor is it any way surprising that the Cold War should erupt into a shooting war in Korea, or latterly in Vietnam. But did America enter into any military commitment willingly? Certainly not without argument.
When it comes to talking, I think the chairman said his share. Well, the chairman's chairman.
That's right.
He can run the meeting any way he cares to. If he wants to cut me off, or that's
it. Oh, no, I'm not, but I want to proceed and not just sit here and hear you talk all the time.
As far as I'm concerned, if I'm going to be here by sufferance and you've invited me to ask some questions, I'd like to ask them. If you don't want me here, I'll be perfectly, I withdraw.
Well, that's all I want
yeah,
you to
but
do.
I don't want to be cut off by intimidation or accused of making long speeches when I've asked at least 24 questions in the last 15 minutes. And I'm asking questions that the American citizens are interested in. The fathers and mothers of the United States of America, and they've got a right to know.
Suppress anything except bombast and gasconade.
All right. Burlesque shows.
Hoorah.
That, by the way, was a fairly typical scene from the so-called Great Debate of 1951. I said at the beginning that greatness had been thrust upon America, and there can be little doubt in most minds that it has been, and that the process has not been altogether a happy one for Americans, for it has jolted them rather sadly out of many of their earlier ideas and beliefs. The 50s, for instance, saw many a cherished hope reluctantly abandoned. Some of the statements from the 50s, of course, sound no less odd today than that which I quoted from Herbert Hoover. Here are a few, taken almost at random. Said Secretary Dulles, for instance, back in the early days,
by the test of conception, birth, nurture, and obedience, the Mao Zedong regime is a creature of the Moscow Politburo, and it is on behalf of Moscow, not on behalf of China, that it is seeking to destroy the friendship of the Chinese people toward the American people.
Which sounds a little odd this week. So does this suggestion from Senator McCarran.
We should immediately sever diplomatic relations with the gang of international outlaws which pose as the government of Soviet Russia and her satellites. This is not a step toward war, but is a last hope to drive a wedge between an unholy band of mad marauders and one-third of the people of the world who are under their domination.
As for the question of admitting Red China to the United Nations, Senator Noland expressed himself thus.
On the day that Communist China is voted into membership in the United Nations, I shall resign my majority leadership in the Senate, so that without embarrassment to any of my colleagues or to the administration, I can devote my full efforts in the Senate and throughout the country to terminate United States membership in that organization and our financial support of it.
Or as they put it in one of the New York shows of the time,
Red China does not exist.
Perhaps a mood of cynicism and disillusion is only to be expected in an age dominated by the shadow of the bomb, certainly among the beats. Let me quote Allen Ginsberg, for example, who led his generation in protest against almost everything.
America, when will you be angelic? When will you take off your clothes? When will you look at yourself through the grave? When will you be worthy of your million Trotskyites? America, why are your libraries full of tears? America, when will you send your eggs to India? I'm sick of your insane demands. When can I go into the supermarket and buy what I need with my good looks? America, after all, it is you and I who are perfect, not the next world. Your machinery is too much for me. You made me want to be a saint. There must be some other way to settle this argument.
Nor was poetry alone in responding to the nuclear age in a new manner. Following the beats, there came the beat, with interesting results when the two got together.
Kill, kill, kill for peace. If you don't kill them, then the Chinese will. If you don't want America to play second fiddle. Kill, kill, kill for peace. Kill, kill, kill for peace. If you let them live, they may subvert the Prussians. If you let them live, they might love the Russians.
Well, America since the bomb will be about that sort of thing, no less than the course of history, out of which, it seems to me, much of the writing and the singing and the talking of our time are still being made. Never before, perhaps, has the mood in America changed so rapidly or so radically as it has in the last 21 years. It would be wrong to suggest that the bomb alone has been responsible for all the changes, but it would be equally wrong to pretend that it hasn't been responsible, directly or indirectly, for many of them. Most of all, perhaps, the bomb has put an end to the habit of conformity in America, as witness the present disagreements upon the war in Vietnam. A new generation has come of age in the nuclear age, a generation which does not accept authority as such, but knows that it can all too often be arbitrary. The mood of that new generation is also reflected in American song, and it is with the song that I shall end these introductory remarks. The song is called It Isn't Nice, and the singer is Judy Collins.
They murdered boys in Mississippi. They shot Medgar in the back. Did you say that wasn't proper? Did you stand out on the track? You were quiet just like mice. Now you say that we're not nice. But if that's freedom's price, mind. Sing it out, we don't mind.
In that talk, D.G. Brideson was introducing the new third program series, America Since the Bomb. The series will open with W.H. Auden's The Age of Anxiety, a reading by way of prologue. This can be heard in the third program tomorrow night at 20 to 7.